and welcome to the Russian Empire History Podcast, the history of all the peoples of the Russian Empire. I'm your host, J.P. Bristow. This is Season 1, The Forest, the Steppe, and the Birth of the Russian Empire, and Episode 45, Vladimir II, Monomach. Before we begin, thank you to new boyar Sparklemoss, PayPal subscriber Jürgen, and the new subscribers on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. This is episode 45, at least of the main narrative. It's actually the 65th episode overall. I wondered whether people might like to do a Q&A episode for episode 50. So if you have a question about anything we have covered, send it to hello@therussianempirehistorypodcast.com or message me on Twitter or Facebook, and I'll add a comment box on Spotify for anyone who listens there. Anyway, on with the story. The chroniclers tell us that on the death of Sviatopolk, the people of Kiev sent to Vladimir, asking him to come and take the throne of his father and grandfather. Despite the formula, Vladimir's succession was not quite within the system established by the testament. So he did not respond immediately, which resulted in rioting in the city. The Kievans plundered the compound of Putyata the Tysiatsky. Tysiatsky were military commanders of 1,000 men, and attacked the Jews and plundered them. Then they sent another, somewhat threatening message to Vladimir, quote, "Come, king, to Kiev. If you do not come, know that much evil will be stirred. Not only the plundering of Putyata's compound and of the Sotsky or of the Jews, but they will attack your sister-in-law and the boyars and the monasteries, and you, king, will be responsible when they plunder the monasteries." End quote. So Vladimir was persuaded. He travelled to Kiev and was welcomed by the people of the city and the metropolitan. He sat on the throne of his father and his grandfather, and the people, says the tale, were glad. As with Vladimir's son Mstislav being acclaimed by the people of Novgorod, the chronicler clearly wants us to see this popular support as evidence for Vladimir's legitimacy. The chronicler is biased. Vladimir and his heirs paid great attention to giving themselves a positive presentation, but this does not mean that Vladimir was not the popular choice. The chronicle even includes a text called the Pouchenie, or Instruction of Vladimir Monomach, which is addressed to his sons. The text comprises a section describing their religious and social duties, then his autobiography, detailing his missions and campaigns, and a letter to Oleg Sviatoslavich of Chernihiv. This text is the earliest surviving written work from Rus that is not written by a monk. From this text, we learn that Vladimir acquired his surname, Monomach, from his mother, an imperial princess of Byzantium. Historians agree that she was the daughter of Constantine IX Monomachus, but as usual, the tale sees no reason to record any information about a woman. But this is far from our first encounter with Vladimir Monomach. He has already been popping up in our story for several episodes. We have seen him involved in the agreements reached among the senior rulers and the allocation of cities to the more junior families. He has led armies and successfully campaigned against the Polovtsi. He's also yet another king of Kiev who reaches the throne after out-surviving other candidates, finally getting there at the age of 60, an old man by the standards of his day, although he will rule for a reasonable 13 years. But he hasn't out-survived all the other candidates. Strictly speaking, it's not his turn at all. And he could have done it earlier, when it was even more not his turn. We've already seen him in Kyiv with the throne there for the taking, but he chose to step back and let it go to Sviatopolk. Why? Although he was popular and might well have been able to carry the people of Kyiv with him, taking Kyiv would have been outside the line of succession based on the testament, and therefore of questionable legitimacy. On the other hand, we have seen the core rulers of Rus working together to gradually circumvent that succession system, excluding rivals and reinforcing their own power. Perhaps Vladimir had been scheming all along, following a long-term plan with the ultimate aim of taking the throne, building his influence behind the scenes, waiting for the moment when he would have no serious rivals remaining. We have been following a narrative of Rus as the land of many kings, where the centralizing paradigm familiar from English or French history does not apply. But what if that's not entirely true? Let's step back a minute and revisit the pathway that brought us here from a different angle, one in which there was a plan to create a centralized Rus. Sivalod, Vladimir's father, had been the junior of the three sons of Yaroslav the Wise, who were designated as heirs to Kyiv when Yaroslav died. Although, as you may remember, the tale claims that he was the favourite son. As the junior brother, he was assigned to Pereyaslavl, a lesser city than Kyiv and Chernihiv that was more vulnerable to attack from the steppe. But it was also part of the Rus heartland, sat on the trade route to Byzantium, and controlled some valuable land. With the arrival of the Polovtsi, its position, as well as that of the southern cities of Rus generally, became even more vulnerable. The Polovtsi were the most dangerous steppe people that the Rus had yet faced, even though they were not aiming at conquest. Their aim was plunder and captives to be sold into the Black Sea slave trade. It took just a couple of years for the sons of Yaroslav to begin deviating from the line of succession that the testament dictated. Vyacheslav Yaroslavich, who held Smolensk, died and should have been succeeded by his son Boris. Instead, the three senior brothers, Izyaslav, Sviatoslav, and Vsevolod, ordered their last surviving younger brother, Igor, to give up Vladimir and Volynia and move to the less desirable Smolensk. As there was then no brother to take over Vladimir and Volynia, it reverted to the direct control of Kyiv. From Vladimir's description of his missions in the instruction, we can see that his father sent him to Vladimir and Volynia and Smolensk several times, although not during the period when Sviatoslav usurped Kyiv and installed his own son in the western city. Some historians interpret this as more evidence of the trio working together, with Vladimir fulfilling missions on behalf of his father and Izyaslav. He also travelled to the Poles to negotiate peace with them after Sviatoslav took Kyiv. And this would not be the only time that the brothers would disregard Yaroslav's instruction not to interfere with the patrimony of the family members. Igor Yaroslavich, the brother who had been displaced to Smolensk, died 4 years later. He had two sons, David and Vsevolod, and by the succession system, they should have inherited his throne. But once again, the senior brothers stepped in, blocked Boris from succeeding to Smolensk, and divided the land of Smolensk among themselves. most likely with the city of Smolensk itself returning to the direct control of Kiev, just like Vladimir in Volhynia. Despite this, it seems that at some point Smolensk came under the sole control of Vsevolod, and Vladimir tells us in his instruction of several visits, including one in which he returns to his father and presents him with 300 hryvnia of gold, presumably tribute collected from the people of Smolensk, which meant that Vsevolod was the ruler of Smolensk. After the death of Izyaslav, Vsevolod became the ruler of Kiev, which presented him with a slight conundrum. He had only two sons, Vladimir and Rostislav, and clearly they needed to rule in Chernihiv and Pereyaslavl. He also had potential rivals for himself and his sons among the sons of his elder brothers. This consideration probably lay behind his generous appointment of Yaropolk Izyaslavich to Vladimir in Volhynia, as well as confirming him in Turov, which was part of his patrimony. This made Yaropolk a significant political power and earned his loyalty, but also moved him further away from Kiev than Vyshhorod, the town he had previously held. For a while, at least. If you've listened to the previous episodes, you'll know what happened. David Igorovich was raiding merchant caravans to get Vsevolod's attention, quite successfully. Vsevolod gave him Dorogobuzh, previously under the control of Yaropolk, which brought his loyalty to a swift end. When he turned rebel, Vsevolod sent Monomakh to deal with him. Yaropolk fled into exile with the Poles for a few years. He came back eventually, with a peaceful settlement apparently on offer, but was then murdered in somewhat dubious circumstances. While these reshuffles were consolidating Vsevolod's influence in the west, there were also acquisitions in the northeast. The Novgorod Chronicle and the Tale of Bygone Years don't quite agree with each other on the allocations to the sons of Yaroslav. The Novgorod Chronicler tells us that Izyaslav took Kiev, Novgorod, and the other Kievan towns. Sviatoslav took Chernihiv and the east as far as Murom, and Vsevolod took Pereyaslavl, Rostov, Suzdal, Bieloozere, and the Volga region. On the other hand, the tale tells us that Sviatoslav's man Jan Vyshhata was out collecting tribute from Bieloozere, which means that he controlled it. However, Vsevolod does appear to have taken over, since Monomakh tells us in the instruction that his father sent him to Rostov while he was still young, before Sviatoslav died. Unfortunately, while the chronicles quite often tell us who is collecting tribute where, they often just skip over how they ended up with the rights to do so. In this case, what many historians believe is that the brothers swapped some of the land that they had been given by their father around. You can see that for one of the elder brothers, whether Izyaslav in Kiev or Sviatoslav in Chernihiv, giving their younger brother an outlying but profitable territory in exchange for land contiguous with their other holdings would help them consolidate and strengthen their rule. In the tale, we see the three brothers collaborating to divide up land among themselves when another ruler has died, so it seems possible for us to also think of them redividing holdings among themselves to optimize their possessions. Vladimir paints a picture in the instruction of him acting as his father's representative throughout Vsevolod's lands, traveling all over to visit Rostov, Suzdal, the Volga region, which likely meant the area around Yaroslavl, as well as the western regions and Poland. These towns had been less significant possessions from which tribute was collected, but sometime after they had passed into Vsevolod's control, they were upgraded to domains with representatives or princes of their own. In this case, Monomakh's oldest son, Mstislav, became the prince of Rostov. After Sviatoslav seizes Kiev from Izyaslav, with Vsevolod's assistance, the instruction relates how Vladimir was sent to Turov on his father's business, a city that Vsevolod likely received as a reward for supporting Sviatoslav. As you'll recall, with Sviatoslav's death, Vsevolod surrendered Kiev, which he could have claimed, to Izyaslav, who returned from exile. This time he was rewarded with Chernihiv, but would be back in Kiev just over a year later when Izyaslav died. When Vsevolod took the throne in Kiev, Vladimir was 25 years old. Already an experienced representative of his father and a seasoned warrior. Vsevolod's only other son, Rostislav, was just 8. As the brothers had to be appointed to the key cities of Chernihiv and Pereyaslav, Vsevolod had to look outside of his immediate family for appointments to the other cities that he controlled, Rostov, Turov, Smolensk, Vladimir, and Volhynia. We have already seen that Vsevolod's assertion of control over the lands of the Sviatoslavichi will lead to conflict. But we also see that by the end of his reign, Vsevolod ruled all the domains that the tale tells us Yaroslav had bequeathed to his sons. The only parts of Rus remaining outside his control were Polotsk, Tmutarakan, and Murom. And despite everything we've been saying in previous episodes about an observable system of succession existing in Rus, he has achieved this by repeatedly violating that supposed system and Yaroslav's instruction that his heirs should not touch each other's domains. First, the three brothers grabbed the patrimonies of their two younger brothers. Then Vsevolod helped Sviatoslav drive Izyaslav out of Kiev. When Izyaslav returned, Vsevolod took Chernihiv, which should have gone to the sons of Sviatoslav. As king in Kiev, he denied the Rostislavichi their right to Novgorod and Alek Sviatoslavich's right to Chernihiv. After Yaroslav had divided his kingdom, it looks like Vsevolod had centralized it again, and when he died, he became the only one of the three brothers to be buried beside Yaroslav in St. Sophia. Vladimir Monomakh was at his father's side from an early age, clearly his reliable and capable assistant throughout his rule, constantly popping up in the tale, and by his own account, enforcing his father's rule across the kingdom. When his father died, Vladimir was in Kiev. Sviatopolk was in Turov. The throne was there for the taking, and given that, by all accounts, Vsevolod and Vladimir were popular with the people of Kiev, it's probable that he could have found their support. However, as we've already heard, he did not assert his claim and stepped aside to allow Sviatopolk to take the city following the tradition of lateral succession. The most likely reason is that he decided that there was too much potential opposition from the other families. Besides Sviatopolk, the sons of Sviatoslav also had a claim to Kiev where their father had ruled, not to mention Chernihiv. As the son of the younger brother in the previous generation, Vladimir's claim came behind all of them. The risk of conflict was too high, so Vladimir chose caution. According to the accounts in the Chronicle, which, of course, we must remember may be putting their own spin on the events, Vladimir and Svyatopolk became brothers-in-arms and close confidants, maybe even equals, rather than Svyatopolk taking seniority as the ruler of Kiev. Almost as soon as he takes the throne, Svyatopolk has to turn to Monomakh for military assistance against the Polovtsi, whom he had provoked by taking their envoys captive. The campaign was a disaster, with the Rus suffering heavy defeats and Monomakh's brother, Rostislav, killed crossing the Stugna. Interestingly, even though he had never ruled in Kiev, Rostislav's body was recovered and interred beside his father and Yaroslav in St. Sophia, an honour that, once again, none of the other princes or rulers of Kiev had earned. Rostislav's death left Vladimir with only young sons to support his cause, not the best position in a system that relied on appointing family members to control the family's domains. And it seems that he was arguing with Svyatopolk over how territories were to be distributed. Although Svyatopolk continued to support Vladimir holding most of the lands his father had controlled, Svyatopolk wanted his own son in Novgorod, then held by Vladimir's son, Mstislav. The outcome was a compromise. Vladimir agreed to move Mstislav to Rostov, but he refused to allow Svyatopolk's son into Novgorod. Instead, David Svyatoslavich was appointed. In 1094, Vladimir again demonstrated his ability to compromise when Aleg Svyatoslavich came from Tmutarakan to reclaim Chernihiv. According to the instruction, Monomakh agreed to withdraw and surrender the city out of pity for his Christian subjects. The city would never return to the rule of the Vsevolodovichi. There was better news from Novgorod in the following year. The townspeople threw out David Svyatoslavich and sent emissaries to Rostov to ask Mstislav to return, which he did, while David Svyatoslavich resumed control of Smolensk. 40 years later, when Aleg's son, also Vsevolod, tried to appoint a new ruler, the tale tells us that the people of the city retorted, "We do not want your son or your brother or your family. We want the family of Vladimir Monomakh." Vladimir's second son, Izyaslav, joins the story at this point, occupying Murom, and thereby increasing the hostility between Monomakh and Aleg Svyatoslavich. With the situation with the raiding Polovtsi still critical, Svyatopolk and Vladimir demanded that Aleg fall into line with their efforts to defend Rus. They sent him a message ordering him to appear in Kiev and pledge to cooperate with them before the bishops. Aleg saw Kiev as a hostile forum and the bishops as a tribunal and refused to comply. Taking an either for us or against us approach, Svyatopolk and Vladimir took the refusal for a declaration that he was on the side of the steppe raiders and declared war. Svyatopolk and Vladimir's belief that a lack of unity among the cousins made Rus vulnerable was borne out by the Polovtsi raiding their cities while they were off fighting Aleg. The tale is silent on the details as usual, but we can infer from the context that Aleg was indeed in alliance with some of the steppe raiders, and they had attacked in response to his request for assistance. Vladimir and Svyatopolk once again showed a willingness to compromise and declared that they were ready to settle with Aleg as soon as he abandoned his steppe allies and aligned with them. As far as we can tell from the sources, there is no reason to believe that they ever had an ulterior motive when they summoned him to Kiev. They appear to have regarded him as an equal member of the clan, and we have no evidence that Vladimir ever cast doubt on his claim to Chernihiv or wanted to retake the city. All signs point to them being sincere in seeking a united front against the Polovtsi. Despite this, the hostilities continued. Vladimir's son Izyaslav was killed when Oleg took Murom. Then he moved against Rostov, Suzdal, and Bielorussia. This was an escalation. Murom had been his initially, these cities had not. In Novgorod, Mstislav made an attempt at reconciliation before his father could retaliate. He sent a message to Oleg asking him to withdraw his posadniki from Monomakh towns in exchange for persuading his father to make peace with him. According to the tale, Oleg rejected the offer because he planned to take Novgorod too. Mstislav, who will also earn the title of the Great, marched out of Novgorod and showed why by defeating Oleg and recapturing the lost cities. In a bit of an ironic moment, Vladimir, who had attacked Oleg for allying with the Polovtsi, sent his own Polovtsi allies to reinforce Mstislav. Mstislav smashed Oleg's forces at a battle on the river Kolokshe, and Oleg fled to Ryazan and then to refuge with his brother David in Smolensk. Mstislav, who was actually Oleg's godson, wrote to him again asking him to seek peace with Vladimir and Svyatopolk and promising to speak to his father on his behalf. This time, Oleg agreed. We have arrived again at the Treaty of Lubecz, which would form the basis for the remaining political history of Rus. According to Martin Dimnik in Power Politics in Kievan Rus, quote, it was Monomakh who, with Svyatopolk's concurrence, manipulated the decrees of the princes to his advantage and that of his descendants. In effect, the decisions of the princes made at Lubecz served as the foundation for Monomakh's supremacy in Rus. End quote. From this position, the context of the Lubecz Agreement is twofold. First, Svyatopolk and Vladimir aimed to lock Oleg into their side against the Polovtsi. Against them, Oleg and the other princes, the Rostislavichi in Galicia and David Igorovich in Vladimir in Volhynia, were looking to guarantee their domains. They had watched Izyaslav, Svyatoslav, and Vsevolod push members of the clan out of their patrimonies, appropriate lands, and make them all dependent on the goodwill of whoever managed to reach the throne in Kiev. So they were looking to lock in the allocations made by Vsevolod as the possessions of their families. And from what we read in the chronicle, it appears that these arguments were accepted and that Svyatopolk and Monomakh acknowledged that respecting the hereditary rights of the other families was essential to peace and unity, and that therefore, unlike their fathers, they would not confiscate land from the weaker princes. The settlement reiterated most of the allocations that had previously been made. The Svyatoslavichi were given back their patrimonial domain in Chernihiv. David Igorovich was confirmed in Vladimir in Volhynia, but not everything was restored. The Rostislavichi were barred from holding Novgorod, which Yaroslav had given to their grandfather. As we have seen, the people of Novgorod had already decided that they would be choosing their own ruler. So the Rostislavichi were given domains in Galicia that satisfied them for now, and the people of Novgorod were not antagonized by an attempt to impose a new lord on them. Oleg did not escape any consequences for allying with the Polovtsi against his fellow Rus. The chronicle, which lists brothers in order of seniority, shows that he was demoted below his younger brother David, who now became the head of the Svyatoslavichi when the treaty confirmed their domains. Still, this has to be seen as a good outcome for him. After all, he had attacked Monomach's cities and killed his son. More serious punishment could have been justified. However, beyond Aleg's personal penalty, there was another reordering of seniority. The tale names the princes arriving at the meeting as follows: Sviatopolk, Vladimir Monomach, David Igorovich, Vasilko Rostislavich, and in last place, David and Aleg Sviatoslavich. As Sviatoslav was the second oldest after Izyaslav, the Sviatoslavichi should have come after Sviatopolk, following the genealogical order of seniority. The chronicler here is reflecting that the Sviatoslavichi had lost the political battle and at this point were not in possession of any domains. Once the gathering approved the agreement among them, the Sviatoslavichi are upgraded, but only to the third place, behind Sviatopolk and Monomach, not their rightful position between them. It's probable that Monomach was behind this. The chronicler does not address it specifically, but the result is that Vladimir becomes next in line for the throne of Kiev. Had the Sviatoslavichi remained ahead of him in precedence, and there was a third younger brother, Yaroslav, as well as David and Aleg, it's highly doubtful that Monomach would ever have made it to the throne of Kiev. Instead, the Sviatoslavichi are demoted, and when the time comes, they do not challenge Vladimir's right to take Kiev. So the outcome of the Lubitsch Agreement was not only to settle the hostilities between Monomach and Aleg Sviatoslavich, but also to secure Monomach's succession to Kiev. And in contrast to Yaroslav's testament, which made the ruler of Kiev the protector of the patrimonies of his brothers, at Lubitsch, they all agreed that if any one of them attacked any other one, all of the others would unite to punish the attacker. This provision was likely intended as a counterbalance to the power of Kiev, since, as we have seen, it was usually the ruler of Kiev who violated the disposition of domains. As previously, it did not take long before the agreement was violated, this time with the incident we've discussed in which Vasilko was taken and blinded, a shocking punishment uncharacteristic for Rus, which was, despite the agreement just mentioned, carried out by Sviatopolk, the ruler of Kiev, under the influence of David Igorovich. Vladimir Monomach and the Sviatoslavichi united to take action against Sviatopolk, who justified himself as taking precautions against the plot that had been revealed to him by David Igorovich. The tale has Monomach and the Sviatoslavichi abandoning punitive action against Sviatopolk due to the intercession of the people of Kiev, but the actual reason may be somewhat different. Although the cousins had all agreed on what should be done if a prince's domain was attacked, there had been no attack on a domain. Instead, there had been the unexpected and unprecedented personal mutilation of Vasilko. They therefore decided that Sviatopolk, as the senior ruler in Kiev, and despite being the one who actually carried out the crime, should punish David for initiating the incident. You'll recall from last episode that Sviatopolk did not intervene and the conflict in the West continued to escalate. The most likely explanation is that without military support from Monomach or the Sviatoslavichi, who were preoccupied with the Polovtsi, he was not able to do anything alone. Dissatisfaction with the outcome of the Lubitsch Agreement may have been the fuel for the ongoing conflict in the West. Vladimir Monomach had been the big winner. All the other cousins had ended up with less than they could potentially have claimed. So, after 4 years of conflict, a new conference was called at Uvietichi, with Sviatopolk Vladimir Monomakh and David and Oleg Sviatoslavich. The chronicler says that they concluded a peace, which is a little strange since they were not at war with each other. What most likely happened is that Sviatopolk was forced to agree to stop trying to seize the domains of the Rostislavichi. They then proceeded to try David Igorovich for his crimes. The tale shows that Monomakh led the tribunal and was the spokesman for the senior rulers. As we heard last time, David was stripped of his patrimony for the crime of drawing his sword against them and maiming his brother, and the western towns were reshuffled. Sviatopolk dropped his claims to Galicia, and Monomakh appeared to have finally achieved his aims, a united front against the Polotsi and himself as heir to Kiev. The arrival of a joint force in the steppe seems to have impressed the nomads. Before any fighting could begin, the Khans were sending messages asking for peace, and on 15 September 1101, the Rus and the Polovtsi met at Sakov, downriver from Kiev, and concluded an agreement that would last for 2 years. Meanwhile, Sviatopolk was still feeling deprived, and now he wanted Novgorod restored to its previous relationship with Kiev, and his son as ruler in place of Vladimir's son, Mstislav. The people of Novgorod were opposed. The Novgorod Chronicle states that Mstislav was a very popular ruler in the city, where he would remain for 20 years. The people remembered that when Sviatopolk had been given the rule of Novgorod, he had preferred to abandon them for Turov. So, no thanks, we'll just keep Mstislav. With Novgorod firmly in his family's control, Vladimir running the congresses of the princes and deciding justice for offending members of the clan, it's hard to avoid the conclusion that Monomakh was already the most powerful ruler in Rus. This impression would be reinforced when the peace with the Polovtsi ended. In the spring of 1103, Vladimir Monomakh and Sviatopolk summoned the princes of Rus for a joint campaign into the steppe. They marched on April 4th and reached the enemy, what the tale calls a countless force, 4 days later. As the commander-in-chief, Monomakh led the Rus to a crushing victory that left 20 Khans dead on the battlefield and the Rus laden down with loot. The defeat left the Polovtsi unable to amount more than the occasional minor raid for several years. When the nomads were able to gather forces again in 1107, they raided the surrounds of Pereyaslavl. Monomakh summoned the princes once again, leading his own men with troops from Kiev and Chernihiv, and accompanied by his sons Vyacheslav and Yaropolk. He crossed the Sula and caught the Polovtsi by surprise in their camp, resulting in another major victory. The years spent bringing the kings and princes of Rus together to face the threat from the steppe looked like they were bearing fruit. Perhaps the Polovtsi also knew the threat they faced. Over the next few years, they concentrated their attacks on Monomakh's land, reaching the outskirts of Pereyaslavl in raids that left his towns devastated. So, in 1111, claiming that he had been advised by angels that it was time for their ultimate defeat, Vladimir Monomakh once again summoned the armies of Rus to his side. All the senior rulers came, Sviatopolk and his son Yaroslav, David Sviatoslavich, the sons of Oleg Sviatoslavich, Sevolod and Sviatoslav, and David Igorovich. Leaving at the end of February, they reached the Don after 4 weeks and burned the town of Sugrov. On Friday 24th of March, the Polovtsi attacked but were driven off. At Easter, they attacked again. There was fierce fighting with heavy losses on both sides. Finally, Monomach and David Sviatoslavich led a cavalry charge which shattered the enemy host. According to the tale, the victory was achieved through divine intervention. When Vladimir Monomach asked his captives why they had tried to flee instead of standing and fighting, they answered, "How could we fight when terrifying others in shining armor riding above your heads were assisting you?" This was the greatest victory against the Polovtsi the Rus had achieved to date, and there would be no more raids from the steppe until after Vladimir Monomach's death. The chronicler clearly gives the credit to Monomach, aided by God of course, as the leader of the Allied forces. So despite him theoretically not being in line for the throne, it should not be any real surprise that when Sviatopolk died 2 years later, the people of Kiev called for Rus' divinely favoured commander, the man who had already been the force behind Sviatopolk's rule, to come and take the throne. Although not mentioned in the tale, the Polish chronicler Dlugosz states that Sviatopolk's son Yaroslav was in Kiev when his father died, but the people were not willing to accept anyone other than Monomach. So why did he delay? The most likely explanation is that despite all the prominence he'd achieved, the military glory and the presumed agreement with Alek Sviatoslavich, there was still a risk that the other princes, especially the other Sviatoslavichi, would not accept this deviation from genealogical seniority. However, in the end they did not resist. Some historians see this as proof of an explicit agreement between them that had been approved by Sviatopolk as the ruler of Kiev and reflected in the reordered list of cousins in the tale. Others argued that it was the threat of military force that made Alek acquiesce. Or maybe it was not possible for anyone to take the throne against the wishes of the people of Kiev. And as Vladimir ends up outliving the Sviatoslavichi brothers, their line will lose its claim to Kiev to Vladimir's descendants, and the people of Kiev will remain loyal to the Monomach family until the Mongols sack the city. Unlike his father, Vladimir took the throne with a good supply of sons. He had 8 of them. The eldest, Mstislav, was well on the way to earning his own prestige and authority as the ruler of Novgorod and a successful military leader. The second eldest, Izyaslav, had been killed fighting Alek, but the others also needed domains of their own. Sviatoslav was given Pereyaslavl, but died not long after and was replaced by Yaropolk. Vyacheslav was sent to Smolensk. Yuri was given Suzdalia. The two youngest, Roman and Andrei, would have to wait. Monomach's historical reputation rests on his successful state building. According to the sources, he was a patron of literature, issued laws and charters, founded new towns, built fortifications and churches, and had the first bridge built across the Dnieper. He consolidated power by placing his sons in the major domains, compelling oaths of loyalty from the other princes, and by campaigning against outlying domains like Minsk that resisted his authority. Alek Sviatoslavich, with whom Monomach had reached agreement on the succession, died in 1115. This raised the problem that his younger brothers, David and Yaroslav, who now moved up the line to become Monomach's potential successors, might not go along with the revised order of succession that he had imposed. Vladimir moved Mstislav from Novgorod to Bilgorod, a fortified town near Kiev, appointing Mstislav's son Vsevolod to rule in Novgorod. Mstislav began acting alongside Vladimir, clearly being positioned as the heir apparent rather than David Sviatoslavich. As far as royal systems of inheritance go, might usually makes right, and Vladimir was unquestionably the most powerful man in Rus. But this move appears to have triggered a revolt by Sviatopolk's son, Yaroslav, who also had a claim ahead of Mstislav. The tale does not provide details, but states that Monomakh attacked him in 1117 to punish his insubordination. After a 60-day siege, Yaroslav surrendered and pledged his allegiance, but the following year he repudiated his marriage to Mstislav's daughter, a serious insult. Monomakh gathered his troops again, and Yaroslav fled to Hungary. His domain was given to Roman, and when Roman died, to the youngest of the Monomashi, Andrei. In 1123, Yaroslav Sviatopolchich, allied with Volodar and Vasilko of Galicia, the Hungarians and the Poles, and laid siege to Andrei in Vladimir and Volhynia. But before Vladimir and Mstislav could come to his aid, Yaroslav was murdered by the Poles. The reign of the Izyaslavichi was over, and the Monomashi would remain the rulers of Vladimir in Volhynia until the Mongol invasion. To the south, Monomakh continued expanding Rus into the steppe. He sent a campaign led by his son Yaropolk to reinforce the Rus position on the Danets and took the towns of Sugrov, Sharukan, and Balin. The Polovtsi were forced to withdraw deeper into the steppe, and a subsequent campaign was unable to find them in the region. But it was not all hostilities. Monomakh also pursued diplomatic ties with the steppe and married his youngest son, Andrei, to a Polovtsian princess. So by 1125, Monomakh's sons ruled in Turov, Vladimir, Smolensk, Pereyaslavl, and Rostov-Suzdal, and Mstislav's placement in Bilhorod was securing Kiev. Vladimir personally controlled most of Rus, and the Sviatoslavichi of Chernihiv, Rostislavichi of Galicia, and Vsyaslavichi of Polotsk were his sworn vassals. It would seem that, if there was a plan, two generations of work had achieved Sevalod's and Vladimir's ambition to build a united Rus. But haven't we already been here with Yaroslav? And just like with Yaroslav, the awarding of domains to the son of Monomakh will create the forces to defeat that centralization. Vladimir Monomakh died on May 19th, 1125. In a church near Pereyaslavl, after ruling in Kiev for 13 years. The people of Kiev mourned him, and he was buried beside his father and brother in St. Sophia. His five sons combined were still the dominant power in Rus, and Mstislav succeeded him as he had intended. The instruction of Vladimir Monomakh, incorporated into the tale, provides his sons with advice. They should pray every night to expiate the sins they committed during the day. They must support the poor. He cautions them against killing any Christian, even someone guilty of murder. Before kissing the cross to confirm an oath, they should examine their hearts to determine whether they are capable of keeping the oath. They should be friends with bishops and avoid pride. He advises them to maintain strict discipline in their lives and handle their business personally without relying on stewards or captains. They should set their own sentries and rise early to check their troops. He tells them not to be careless, to avoid lying, drunkenness, and vice, to prevent their men from doing violence to the people of the lands they are passing through, and to feed beggars and strangers. He reminds them that all men are mortal, so they should be kind to the sick and honor the dead. They should love their wives, but give them no power over them. Laziness is the mother of evil. The pursuit of knowledge and good works will earn them honor in their own land and abroad. After describing his 53 years of service to his father, military campaigns and personal rule, he closes, quote, "Let not my sons or whoever else reads this document criticize me. I do not commend my own boldness, but I praise God and glorify his memory because he guarded me, a sinful and wretched man, for so many years in these dangerous vicissitudes, and did not make me inactive or useless for the necessary works of man. As you read this, prepare yourselves for all good works, and glorify God among his saints. Without fear of death or war or wild beasts, do a man's work, my sons, as God sets it before you. If I suffered no ill from war, from wild beasts, from flood, or from falling from my horse, then surely no one can harm you or destroy you unless it is destined by God. But if death comes from God, then neither father nor mother nor brethren can hinder it. And although it is prudent to be constantly upon one's guard, the protection of God is fairer than the protection of man." End quote. Vladimir Monomakh enjoys one of the best reputations in Rus' history. The tale eulogizes him as enlightening the land like the rays of the sun, saying he loved his fellow man, was generous to the poor, and was a great champion of Rus' feared by the pagans. Historians have largely followed in the footsteps of the chronicler. He has been described as a peace-loving prince and the most noble ruler of Rus'. Laws he passed to improve the situation of the common people, such as a prohibition on usury, are emphasized, along with his personal learning and written works, his patronage of the arts and monasteries and building works. He's credited with stabilizing Rus', raising the central authority of Kiev, and making Rus' one of the great powers of Europe. Others note the key role the chronicle gives him in the decades of conflict with the Polovtsi, making his military campaigns, occasionally compared to the Crusades, his main contribution. However, some historians have been more ambivalent. Monomakh murdered the Polovtsian Khans Itla and Kitana, whom he had given safe passage. When he subjugated Polotsk, he slaughtered the townspeople of Minsk. The steps he and Vsevolod took to block other princes from succession have been seen as the cause of the continuous conflicts that ravaged Rus. While he was generous to the poor, temperate, and a tireless campaigner, he has also been accused of only doing anything if he could derive personal benefit from it. But if Vsevolod and Monomakh did indeed have a conscious plan to build a centralized and powerful Rus, rather than merely pursuing their own wealth and power, it was not to last. Join me in the next episode to see how Mstislav and the other brothers follow their father's advice. Thank you for listening, and until next time, goodbye.